Welcome to this special episode of the Urban Astronomer Podcast. My name is Alan Varsfeld, and I am the host and producer of the Urban Astronomer Podcast. This episode was recorded especially for the Hurricane Harvey PodPack project to provide help and supports to the city of Austin, Texas, in the hope that the people who live there might be able to recover and return to their normal lives a little more quickly. I am a section director of the Astronomical Society of South Africa, with a passion for the development of science in my country, so I normally focus on stories relating to work done in South Africa or by South African astronomers, but we are making a special exception today. So I'm going to talk instead a bit about the science behind hurricanes and cyclones in general, and compare earthly hurricanes with those on other worlds in our solar system. Before we begin, a fair warning to anybody listening to this show who believes in any of the various flat earth theories that are out there. Everything I'm about to say is based on the idea of a spherical planet rotating and warmed by a hot, distant sun. If you don't believe in any of that, you are quite welcome to set aside some time of your own to invent your own theory of why weather happens and use it to predict the next hurricane. I would suggest that you ignore the hurricane warnings issued by the authorities as being ball earth propaganda, but, you know, don't do that. I would really hate for anything bad to happen to you, so please, please, trust the scientists on this. If you get told to evacuate because the satellite imagery has shown a hurricane bearing down upon you, please do not start arguing about how satellites are just another NASA hoax. This is not the time for any of that nonsense. Your life could quite literally be on the line. So, what exactly is a hurricane then? Well, okay. To start with, let's imagine that the Earth is a perfectly smooth sphere with a thin atmosphere. The sun shines on one side, warming it up. The warmed up bits then in turn warm up the air touching them, and that air expands and becomes less dense, which means that it becomes lighter than the air above it. So it tries to float up, and the colder air that is already above it gets pushed out the way in various directions. The colder air that's on either side moves in to take up the space left behind by the upwards air, the hot air moving up. It then sinks back down to the ground and gets drawn into the space where it used to be because atmospheric pressure does not like vacuums. Okay, you with me so far? This should be obvious to anyone with a junior school education, because as we all know, hot things expand, hot air rises. This is how hot air balloons fly. I mean, it's very simplified, and I'm ignoring stuff like turbulence and the sideways flows of air that comes from the pressure increases and all of that. All that stuff does happen in real life, but that's okay. We know that the real world is far more complicated than cute little thought experiments like this one, but don't worry, we are going to make things a little more realistic. So we're now going to make this world spin. But unfortunately, since I don't have a video feed, I can't show you any pictures. I'm going to need you to use your imagination for a little bit. We need to understand a few things about how rotating objects behave. So, imagine a bicycle. It's lying on its side, and you've set the front wheel spinning freely. Now, if you look at the rim of that wheel, where the tire is, it's whizzing by at quite a speed. But if you look closer to the axle, things are moving quite slowly. Now, let's imagine a flea standing on the axle. It wants to get to the tire, and it can easily make the distance in a single leap. So it turns to face a spot on the tire, it aims for it, and it leaps. But, much to its surprise, as it sails through the air, the spot that it aimed for seems to start moving off to the side, moving away faster and faster until it's plenty far away, and the flea ends up landing on some entirely different part of the tire. Why? Because although all parts of the wheel are rotating at the same rate, the speed through space of each part of the wheel is quite different. The axle isn't moving through space at all, while the rim is moving quite rapidly, as we saw earlier. Now, if the flea had decided to just walk to the tire by running along one of the wheel's spokes, well, then it would have arrived exactly where it meant to. So what's different about these two cases? Well, when it jumped, it was moving in a straight line. But by walking along the spoke, it's moving sideways as well as outwards. As we watch from our position outside the whole thing, we would have seen the path that the flea actually moves is a big spiral, because the spoke that it's running on is rotating along with the rest of the wheel, and as the flea moves outwards along that spoke, its sideways speed increases to match the speed at that part of the wheel. If the flea moves fast enough, it will actually be able to feel this change in sideways speed as a mysterious force trying to push it sideways off of the spoke. It might not understand what's going on, but from our point of view, standing above it all, we can plainly see exactly where this apparent force is coming from. Okay, so that's what we call the Coriolis effect. Sometimes it's called the Coriolis force. It's pretty much the same thing as centrifugal force, when you think about it, in that it's not really a force at all, it's just the result of your own momentum being swung around a center of rotation. It sure feels like a force, though, to somebody standing on the wheel, so we'll just stick with that terminology. Now, if you replace the bicycle wheel with a ball and said that's spinning, well, the physics are exactly the same here, only now, instead of two dimensions, we have to think about three. If we move along the surface towards one of the poles, well, it's the same thing as moving towards the axle, except we're taking a more scenic route. All that's really changed is that there are now more directions which we can choose to move in to take us there. But the same basic effect happens. Any movements that lead you towards the axis will create a force that tries to move you sideways in the same direction that the ball is spinning, and any movements away from the axle will create another so-called force that tries to push you against the direction of the spinning. Now, I should mention at this point that the bigger the ball is and the slower it turns, the more subtle these forces are going to be. If you or I stand on the surface of the Earth and walk north, the force is going to be too small to notice. But if we take a large mass of air, say a few thousand kilometers across, tens of kilometers high, and gently heat it so that it starts to rise, well, now we're working on a big enough scale to see that force at work. The side of that air mass closest to the pole will very, very slowly start to move in the direction of the Earth's spin, and the side closest to the equator will move against the direction of spin. So, if you take a big mass of air and move one side in one direction and the other side in the other direction, well, the whole thing starts turning. If you want to pause here and think about this, just to get this clear in your head, well, then you should realize after a short while that this is why these things always spin anti-clockwise in the Northern Hemisphere and clockwise in the Southern Hemisphere. Now, if you keep this going, keep adding energy for a long enough time, enough heat causing enough air to rise and circulate and rise again, the whole thing gets to a point at which the winds are blowing at over 60 kilometers per hour, and we then call it a tropical storm. If it gets even bigger, with wind speeds exceeding 120 kilometers per hour, well, then we usually call it a tropical cyclone. Now, tropical cyclone is the correct scientific name, but in common use we tend to use different words depending on where it's happening, based on the local languages. So, if it's in the Indian Ocean, we call it a cyclone. If you're in the Pacific, or for the eastern coasts of Asia and Australia, then we call them typhoons. And if they're in the Pacific or Atlantic near the Americas, then we call them a hurricane. Now again, there's a whole lot more going on here than what I've said. The surface of the Earth, for example, is not a perfectly smooth, hard surface. We've got mountain ranges and deserts and polar ice caps, and we've got oceans, which have their own currents, which transport heat around so that we get warm areas and cold areas, and these all affect the growth of hurricanes. Oceans are far more efficient at creating warm updrafts of air than land is, so hurricanes only form over water and tend to die down after making landfall. There's enough going on here that you really need to spend years and years studying meteorology or climate science to really understand it properly. But the result is that tropical cyclones only form at specific latitudes, which is why they never appear in, say, Canada or Germany or Brazil. This actually brings up a question. Why is an astronomer like me talking about meteorology? Well, other planets have weather too. And even if we decide that weather only means stuff that happens in the atmosphere, like wind and clouds and rain, well, there are seven planets with atmospheres, and a couple of moons too, and weather systems comparable to hurricanes and typhoons are definitely not limited to Earth. So let's go on a quick tour of the solar system to see what the weather is like on other worlds. We'll start near the sun and move outwards. So first stop, Mercury. Well, Mercury has no atmosphere, so the only weather there is space weather. That's streams of radioactive particles and strong magnetic fields, both emitted by the sun. It's dangerous and weird and quite interesting in its own way, but it's not what we're talking about here. So moving on to Venus. Venus is about the same size as Earth, but has a very, very different atmosphere. It is extremely thick, has a permanent 100% cloud cover over the entire surface of the planet, and infrared observations tell us that it is extremely hot. In fact, it was Dr. Carl Sagan who, many years before he worked on the famous Cosmos TV show, he figured out the secrets of Venus's high temperature. And it was runaway global warming caused by too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere trapping sunlight. And it was that science which led to people wondering, well, could this happen on Earth if we continue burning fossil fuels and increasing the amounts of carbon dioxide in our own atmosphere? Anyway, Venus has some extremely fast winds in its upper atmosphere, blowing at speeds of over 350 kilometers per hour, about the same as the most violent hurricanes on Earth. But if you look further down, against the surface, the winds slow right down to only a few kilometers per hour. This is because the atmosphere is so thick and dense down there, and under so much pressure, it's simply too thick and soupy to blow around easily. The pressure, in fact, is equivalent to what a submarine experiences some 80 meters below the surface of the sea. This same atmosphere, by the way, is also hot enough to melt lead. Oh, and it rains sulfuric acid. The only real storms, as far as I could find in my research, are two permanent cyclone-like systems centered around the pole. And these storms each have two eyes, which circle around each other. And as far as I can tell, nobody knows why this is. So the next world then is Earth. But, well, we all know what Earth weather is like because everybody listening to this show already lives there. So moving on, Mars. Mars is about half the diameter of Earth, and it's only about a tenth of its mass, and so Mars has much weaker gravity than us. It also has a very minimal magnetic field, so it hasn't really managed to hold on to much of its atmosphere. What little there is made mostly from carbon dioxide, and at the surface, it's only about 1% of the thickness of Earth's. So, standing on the surface of Earth, you've got about the same amount of air as a commercial airliner on Earth is flying through 10 kilometers above sea level. Now, it's extremely dry as well, so there's no water rain, and there's just not much heat either, so storms don't get very strong. The highest speeds recorded are barely 100 kilometers per hour, and with the air being so thin, they just can't do any damage. What the Martian winds can do is raise clouds of fine dust from the surface, creating both immensely tall dust devils, which have been photographed by Martian rovers and satellites, and gigantic dust storms, some of which grow large enough to cover the entire planet. These we've known about for over 100 years, as they are quite easy to spot from Earth with a large telescope. Next world, Jupiter. And here things really start to get interesting. Jupiter is basically all atmosphere. Although once you get a few hundred kilometers down, the pressure has risen so high that the gases start condensing into a hot liquid. Heat from the sun, plus the internal heat of the planet, plus the total lack of any landmass and the enormous height of the atmosphere, let things get quite exciting. Jupiter is the largest planet in the solar system by a healthy margin, and it shows a constantly changing view through even small telescopes of atmospheric cloud bands and storms. The biggest of these, and most famous, is an anticyclone on the South Equatorial Belt, which has been blowing for a very long time. It's called the Great Red Spot, and it was in full force when Samuel Heinrich Schwabe first saw it through his telescope in 1838. And to any German listeners, I apologize if I pronounced that name wrong. It may even have been the same thing that was reported by Gian Domenico Cassini in 1665. Now, it has subsided somewhat recently. Professional astronomers have been watching it slowly shrink over the last 100 years or so. And in fact, observations by amateur astronomers keeping track since 2012 have shown that it is shrinking along its long axis by about 900 kilometers every year, so that what used to be a huge oval-shaped storm is now a very slightly smaller circular storm. Even still, though, at its current size, you could easily fit two planet Earths inside it with room to spare. It's not just big, though. The winds around its edges have been measured at speeds of almost 700 kilometers per hour. But there's a lot else going on Jupiter. A closer look reveals a constant stream of smaller storms, usually showing white in color, forming chains around the equatorial belts, each one on its own comparable in size to the Earth. These storms flow around the planets, collide and merge on a constant basis, and the fact that astronomers and planetary scientists never think to mention them when talking to the general public just goes to show how stupendously large Jupiter is, that such amazing weather gets lost in the noise. Next world, Saturn. Saturn is most famous for its rings, of course, but equally noteworthy is the recently discovered hexagon around its south pole. The Cassini robotic spacecraft has returned many images of the strange, perfect hexagonal shape, tens of thousands of kilometers across, in the atmosphere centered around the pole. Scientists think they've figured it out, though. It's basically a jet stream, just like we have here in Earth's upper atmosphere, and like Earth's, it undulates in ripples. It just, though, happens to be the right size that these waves in the jet stream resonate, creating a standing wave in the shape of a hexagon. Researchers have managed to create copies of this in tanks of swirling water, and by varying the size of the tank and the speed of the water, they can make hexagons, pentagons, triangles, even squares. So it's not as out there as it sounds. There's also a 500 kilometer per hour hurricane-like storm permanently trapped near Saturn's north pole. Oh, and every now and then, a great white spot forms, similar to Jupiter's red one. It also rains liquid diamond. Next world is Uranus. It should be really interesting because at some point in its past it flipped over onto its side. So instead of turning in such a way that the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, well, instead it just circles through the sky around the poles, depending on the time of year, which should create really interesting and different weather patterns, except that it's so far from the sun that it doesn't get that much heat. The strongest winds aren't much faster than we get here on Earth. Big cyclones seem to form on the equator instead of in the tropics, and there's been a bunch of interesting circulating clouds and thunderstorms near the North Pole that astronomers have been watching for the past decade or so. Now, Neptune, even further from the sun, manages to have upper atmosphere winds blowing faster than the speed of sound somehow. I have no idea what that must sound like. It is believed that Neptune has rains of liquid methane and solid diamonds, thanks mainly to the high pressure and extremely low temperatures found that far from the sun. Aside from that, though, we simply just don't know much about Neptunian weather. It's far enough away that even the Hubble Space Telescope can't really see much detail. And finally, the recently demoted planet Pluto. Well, until very recently, it was assumed that there would be no weather. It's small enough to be a rocky world with not much gas, and at that crazy distance, it's so cold that what atmosphere it does have should just have frozen solid and be lying on the surface as a layer of frost. As it turns out, though, it does have a bit of atmosphere, and its skies are even blue, just like on Earth. But what's the weather like? Nobody knows yet. But hopefully, planetary scientists will be able to figure something out from the masses of data recently returned by the New Horizons probe. So, that's that. Weather on other worlds, sometimes harsher than on Earth, sometimes milder. And yet, no matter how you look at it, no matter how bad things get here on Earth, this is still the only place known in the entire universe where human beings and other animals can roam the surface freely and have any hope of surviving for even just a few minutes. I'd like to thank you for supporting the Hurricane Harvey PodPack project, the proceeds of which are going to support podcasters affected by Hurricane Harvey, and also to assist the relief efforts after Hurricane Harvey in Austin, Texas. As I record this, we are waiting for Hurricane Irma to make landfall in Florida, having already wreaked total havoc on islands in the Caribbean, and is busy working its way through Cuba. And we're still waiting to see what Hurricane Jose is going to do. I'm immensely grateful to live many hundreds of kilometers inland at a latitude where this sort of thing cannot happen. And I can only watch in dull horror as millions of people lose their homes, possessions, and even their lives. Thank you very much for your contribution. On a slightly more upbeat note, though, If you enjoyed this recording and would like to hear more about space and astronomy with hardly any weather at all, come find my website at http://www.urban-astronomer.com and click the podcast link at the top of the page. You'll find all my previous episodes there. This episode will not be listed, since it was recorded exclusively for the Hurricane Harvey Podpack, so most people there will never even hear this. So if you'd like to leave a comment, you can just drop me a mail at podcast@urban-astronomer.com, or you can tweet me at uastronomer. That's the letter U and the word astronomer. If you want to hear more, you can follow the subscribe links to add me to your favorite podcast software. I'm especially interested to hear from experts who want to educate me on any mistakes I might have made in trying to simplify this for a general audience. But anybody else is welcome to reach out as well. I would really like to hear who the people are that chose to support this worthy project. So then, I guess that's me done. Thank you once more for listening. Cheerio and clear skies.